Remote means of union with God. The remote means of union with God are sense objects, anything we can see through the senses. You would say, you ought to see this movie, it's a life of Christ, it has, gives us a good new insight in the life of Christ. That can be true. Not necessarily true. Many of the lives of Christ in the movie are very poor because Christ usually turns out to be a Hollywood figure. But it can be good. It tells us something about Christ. It makes it concrete and definite. But John of the Cross would rate that among the remote means of union with God. Even the most excellent movie would be a remote means of union with God. So slides and pictures, they're good. They'll help us towards God. They can help our pupils. But remember, let's remember their right place, their remote means of union with God. There's a time whenever we outgrow them, or we should outgrow them, and be ready for something better. We're ready at a certain point. In fact, we start to get ready as soon as we reach the age of reason and can make an intelligent act of faith. We start to handle the proximate union means of union with God, because the proximate means of union with God, St. John of the Cross teaches, are faith and hope and love. And in order to practice faith and hope and love, he goes on to teach, we must detach ourselves gradually from merely human knowledge and merely human hopes and merely human loves, even from the love of high things like art and things. They should occupy a secondary, a proportionate place in our life, but we must go beyond them to live the life of faith and hope and love. And the contemplative is one who seeks Christ and God in faith and hope and love alone. He sets aside as completely as we can in this human life all the secondary means of union with God and desires to live by the proximate means. Now, we have to judge by where we are and whom we're teaching when we're teaching these things, but we should keep the pattern in mind, the picture in mind, as to what we're doing. As educators, we should have that in our mind, and as practitioners, we should know our place. You know, whenever you have a child in your parish who's a good football player, and you have visions for a great future, you don't send him right down to Chuck Noll and say, will you try this boy out? He has to go through a lot of training before he can even be dreamed of as eligible for a professional team. So even in sports, we have to, it's not elitism, it's progression in growth. And so we don't put a child, no matter how brilliant, into university. He has to have, even a genius would have to have some training in the elements to do it. So that's the second point there. It helps us to develop an interior life. It is the spirit that gives life. The flesh is of no avail. Thirdly, this is an important point today in our contemporary world. It's only a line there, but it can be developed indefinitely. Seeing creatures as samples helps us at once to admire and respect the earth environment which we inhabit and tend to exploit. We live in the midst of an environmental crisis. We are destroying the very planet in which we live. Not merely fouling it up, but destroying it. Sacking it of all its resources. We've known it for a long time, or suspected it. It became very evident to us about the early 1970s with the oil crisis. And we hear now, this is why we have this group, the environmentalists, that are fighting to preserve some of the beauties and the glory of the environment. But we ransack it, you see, for wealth. We called the great millionaires of America, even back in the 19th century, who exploited all the resources of America, are called by one of the American historians, the robber barons. They exploited it. And that's what we're doing today. We see the results of the exploitation everywhere. Now we're trying to recoup a little bit. The city fathers of Pittsburgh, for example, are trying to recover some of the beauty of the site on which their city is founded. make it more livable, not just a place for factories and technology, but a place for people. But every day, why we exploit the environment more and more, and the environmentalists become very, very unpopular because they prevent money making. We had even in the Department of the Interior of the United States government anti-environmentalists who were exploiting it because they want to feed these robber barons more resources to make more money. Because we still have the robber barons. They didn't all die with the 19th century. The country's loaded with them that are exploiting everything they can. And they don't even pay decent wages to their workers. They have the filter down theory. They make the money and a little bit filters on. A little bit filters on. They take all. So, this is a great problem in the world today. Now, oddly enough, we Christians, together with the Jews, are blamed by many scientists and scholars for this exploitation. We're told that we have misused that text in Genesis which says that we should rule the earth and explore it. We change explore into exploit. That's what the sacred writer says there. Dominate the earth, rule the earth. And so we've taken that only too literally. Of course, the writers in, you know, the 5th century or whatever it was before Christ could not anticipate the modern industrial exploitation of the earth. They knew nothing about that. They couldn't even dream of it. And so they certainly were authorizing something that they had absolutely no experience of. They simply meant that it was put here for man's use, as it is. And we've seen how a man has used it for the glory of God. And he's limited by that. It's a very wide authorization, but it's not unlimited. The glory of God. It means also for the value of the good of our fellow beings and preserve it. So we should be the leaders in this environmental crusade among the environmentalists. But we sit by and watch it. I remember my hometown was McKeesport, PA. I don't know anybody boasts to believe McKeesport, PA. We lived in the smoke of Pittsburgh. And I remember the workers down there, they would say whenever a stranger or visitors talk about the smoke, the great smoke, they'd say that's pay dirt. See, that was the only interest in it. Pay dirt. That means they're getting work and they're getting paid for that. There was no interest in the environment at all, no concern about it. And we were just amazed a few years back when we realized that even the oil resources are limited. Even water resources are limited, and the table of water is going down rapidly. Even topsoil is being wasted by billions of acres every year. I saw a bumper sticker, Pave America. Who needs grass? And that's the way we operate. Who needs vegetation? Pave America. So, this is complete forgetfulness of the truth that God created the earth for His glory. Not for human vainglory, not for our exploitation. We could spend a lot of time on this talking about the robber barons, and I'd like to, but we have to move along. I just give it to you. I would suggest that you might read that book sometime by Matthew Josephson. It's not a spiritual book, but these books, you know, help spiritual, called The Robber Barons, and see what the great fortune hunters of America have done to America. Another book that those of you that are interested, technically interested, might look up is a book called by Tawney. The author's name is Tawney. I shouldn't tell you these things, I guess. They're not really spiritual books, but they support spiritual reading. They are spiritual reading. R.H. Tawney, Religion and the Rise of Industrial Capitalism. Maintains that religion was not detached from these things, but was very much part of it. We had a good example of that in Pittsburgh over the last 6 months or so, in the rebellion in the churches here, the appearance in the churches of these protest groups from the Monongahela Valley, whose plants and works have all been shut down, and they went into the wealthy parishes in Pittsburgh, and they confronted the millionaires in there, and they made an issue of it. It's all died down now, but it wasn't solved. But they were right. They went to the churches. There were certain churches especially that were deeply, they weren't financially involved, but their teachings. Some of the Christian churches reversed the Beatitudes. Instead of blessed are the poor, they became blessed are the rich. And it was precisely those churches that these protesters went to visit. The Lutheran and the Presbyterian. I don't want to get into an ecumenical talk, but it was Calvin, it was the great response, read this in that book, The Religion and the Rise of Industrial Capitalism. They praise the rich and bless the rich and some even saw the possession of riches as a sign of God's predestination to glory. So, it was poetic justice when these churches, they didn't visit the Catholic churches. Not that we're without responsibility, because I think we are, but not so dramatically responsible as they were. They confronted them. It was poetic justice. But the whole thing failed. It fell apart for lack of public support. And I think there's only one reason that it failed. I think it could have been successful. They failed to learn the method of nonviolence from the greatest man who lived in our generation, Mahatma Gandhi. This is the only way they could have won. And since they were clergymen, I thought they might knew that. But apparently they were totally ignorant of Gandhi and his career and his work. And they brought in hired organizers, and they destroyed themselves. I pity the clergymen. I was sympathetic with them. I thought, now we're going to see an example of nonviolent protest and nonviolent crusading from these Lutheran and Presbyterian ministers. But we didn't see it, and it failed. This is the only way these things can win. Martin Luther King demonstrated that to us here. This is the only way, and it's the only way the poor people can rebel without bloodshed and without destruction. But if we had leaders that were skilled and aware of how to work with nonviolence. Anybody, you just don't fold your hands and do nothing. That's not what nonviolence is. Gandhi regretted that word nonviolence because it's too negative. But we have to work to get the results. We might call it with the weapons of the spirit. Gandhi invented a word himself, satyagraha, with spiritual weapons. And St. Paul uses that phrase, weapons of the spirit. And so this would be the only way that we could fight the ones who are exploiting the environment. But we failed in that opportunity, and I will continue to fail. Because we love violence. And we don't love our neighbor. We don't love the poor. And this is terrible here. You see the whole areas, like these industrial areas in Pittsburgh, once the greatest industrial center in the country, you see, now they're empty. And people are starving there and dying. The towns are dying. And that's what these people were protesting about. But Gandhi was the greatest man in our generation just for that. The nonviolence. Nonviolence is the law of nature, Gandhi said, and I believe it. Because it's just the other side of the law of God, which is love the Lord your God with your whole heart and your whole soul and your whole mind. and love your neighbor as yourself, at least that much. So, this is a great crisis that we are in, and we have a difficult time getting out of it. But we Catholics should be involved in it, and we should be doing whatever we can. Everyone. Gandhi wouldn't allow paper to be wasted. And we delight and exult in the fact that so many of our utensils and objects that we use are throwaway. We exploit the environment to get them and throw them away. So, a simple little doctrine like the samples would solve it if it were adhered to and accepted by everyone. The glory of God. The earth has been given to us for the glory of God and to use it. You see, sometimes I've been criticized because I talk, this is not religion, this is sociology or capitalism. It's not. It is religion. To do this. Well, now that will be sufficient for the present. We'll go on with this evening. Now we'll go down and pray and we'll meet at dinner. There's a question in my mind. Should we have more reading at dinner, or should you think you've had enough of that? That was too much of an ordeal for twice a day. Can you stand another one?
Yes.
Okay. We'll have another one then.